Okay, our next case this morning is number 16-1960, Toro v. United States. Mr. Avery.
Good morning. My name is Michael Avery, and I represent Carlos Toro, the appellant in this matter, who is seeking leave to amend his complaint in the United States Court of Federal Claims. Leave to amend a pleading should only be denied where there is undue delay, bad faith, or dilatory motive, repeated failure to cure deficiencies by previous amendments, undue prejudice, or futility of amendment.
Let's start with futility of amendment. Even
yes,
if you amend the way you propose, you still have a statute of limitations problem.
Your Honor, I would suggest that we don't, as Mr. Toro's claims are broken down into distinct investigations, wherein his agreement that will be alleged in the amended complaint...
But they all relate back to the time that he was aware that he wasn't being compensated for this undercover work that he was doing.
Yes, Your Honor. However, the agreement between Mr. Toro and the DEA wasn't for a blanket amount for the entirety of his time. It was for purchase of information for specific, distinguishable, identifiable investigations. So, for example, he would be going to Colombia to investigate a target that would be subject to purchase of information when he returned, provided the information, as well as for reimbursement of his expenses for that particular distinct investigation. So each one of his investigations was subject to purchase of information.
For example, just that allegation right there, how was that supported in the complaint by way of an agreement with the government?
It was not, Your Honor, and that's why we're here.
There's no agreement.
The complaint was inarticulate, and if the court grants leave to amend, Mr. Toro is prepared to provide specific, non-frivolous allegations of the implied in fact contract that will show offer.
Was that material provided in the motion to amend below?
It was not, Your Honor. It was not. I'm prepared to articulate what Mr. Toro will provide in the amended complaint should the court agree
It seems to me that that should have been provided to the court below when the original motion to amend was made.
Well, it should have, Your Honor. It was not, but I don't believe
otherwise,
that's fatal under the
record.
Rule.
It's not in the record, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Now we're looking at it. So how can we review that?
Well, what we're asking you to review is the denial of the leave to amend, that the court favors resolution on the merits, the court's favor allowing an amendment when there has been no undue delay, there's been no prejudice to the government, and the government's really only arguing that futility of amendment, and should the court grant leave to amend, Mr. Toro is prepared to overcome that in his amended pleading. Does that address the court's question?
Well, I just don't see how we can address the issue from your perspective, that you have an agreement now that was not presented to the trial court. The trial court found the complaint to be fatally defective. We have a statute of limitations problems. We can't review the agreement that you purport to have because it's not part of the record.
Well, we're not asking the court to make a decision.
It seems to me to be futile. It's a futile appeal.
Well, I would disagree, Your Honor, in that we're not asking the court to review the sufficiency of the complaint. We're asking the court to allow Mr. Toro to file the amended complaint, which we contend that the judge at the Court of Claims should have granted at the time of the motion.
Any showing to the Court of Federal Claims that the amendment would have cured the deficiencies?
Well, Your Honor, we would make the allegation that the amended complaint would have cured those deficiencies.
Yeah, but along the same lines as both of my colleagues are questioning you, even in your blue brief to us, the only thing that you have alleged anywhere that you would change about the amended complaint is on page 6, where you explain that you would identify the people who he contracted with in 1986, the specific DEA agents. That wouldn't solve the problem of the fact that this contract, you've only ever alleged one contract. It was consummated according to your allegations in 1986, and all you have claimed that you are willing to amend, or the only thing you've put forth below or to us that you would do by way of amendment, is give further detail on that 1986 contract by naming the individuals involved. The problem you have is that none of that could possibly help you overcome the statute of limitations problem that you have. More detail about what occurred vis-a-vis this contract in 86, even if you were able to establish one that existed in 86, doesn't get you over the statute of limitations problem. And that really is the heart of the futility issue that I have.
Your Honor, I would argue that it would, and for the following reason, that the agreement that was made between the DEA agents and Mr. Toro in 1986 was for reimbursement of his expenses and for compensation for the purchase of information for specific investigations. And those specific investigations...
Okay, but that 1986 agreement couldn't have covered investigations that arose later, right? It only covered the ones in 1986.
Correct, Your Honor.
And he knew by... absolutely positively, no later than 2015, that all of the information he was giving between 86 and 2015, he never got a dollar of compensation for. So he knew. So the contract was in 86. From 86 to 2015, he is supplying what is accepted to be useful, valuable information to the government, and he never receives a single penny of compensation despite his concerted efforts. So along that logic, how is it not the case that by 2015 he was surely on notice that the government had no intention to compensate him for all of this and therefore was in unequivocal breach, if assuming all of your facts are correct?
I understand the court's point. But with regard to that, though, Your Honor, I would suggest that from 2009, his complaint was filed in 2015, that anything that was any breaches that occurred between 2009 and 2015 would, in fact, fall within the statute of limitations. Any claims before 2009 may be subject to the statute of limitations and would be futile, but those claims and those breaches that arose for specific distinguishable events for the purchase of information between 2009 and 2015 would be subject to a non-futile amendment. And that,
but even if that were true, you still did not allege in the original complaint who a person with authority to make a contract, or all sorts of details that would be necessary to find a contract, which were missing from the original complaint, and you never told the Court of Federal Claims, and you have never told us, indeed, in your briefs, how you're going to supply those missing elements that are necessary for a contract claim.
I understand, Your Honor. The identity of the individuals was in the original
it's
complaint.
It's not a question of identity of the individuals. It's alleging that there's someone with authority who entered into a contract.
Yes, Your Honor. And those individuals that were in the complaint did have authority, and in the amended complaint...
There's no such allegation.
Well, if the court would grant leave to amend, those specific allegations will be made with those same named individuals through their capacity as special
You
agent.
Never told the Court of Federal Claims that.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's the point.
Even if we were to buy that argument, you're still facing a statute of limitations problem. Are you arguing there's a continuing claim doctrine applicable here?
In the alternative, yes, Your Honor, I am, because these are distinct.
But it doesn't apply. The continuing claim doctrine doesn't apply here.
Well, I would suggest that there it does fit the rationale for the continuing claims. I know the courts have not held it to be so in these informant cases. But if the court will allow the amendment to go forward, then those issues where the distinct investigations which triggered...
It seems like your client is now throwing good money after bad. I mean, if the statute of limitations has told this action, I mean, if you can't go forward with it, then why should we allow you to amend?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the court will allow it to go forward after the amendment when it sees those claims that arose in 2009 to the point of the filing that fall within the statute of limitations that are separate and distinguishable.
Maybe had you made all these arguments and presented adequate data and information to the trial court, then we'd have a basis on which to see if you have an appeal that's worthy. But you don't have that.
Well, Your Honor, had I been allowed to amend at the trial court level, I would have had that. But my motion was denied.
But when you move to amend, I'll say it one more time. When you move to amend, you should have presented that material at that point. And you did not?
I did not, Your Honor, but I would suggest that it's not a fatal flaw and that the court should grant leave to amend to cure that, as there is an allegation that that this can be cured by an amendment.
Well, your allegation is it can be cured by an amendment, but you've given us no specific facts, even on appeal. Forget about before the lower court, that make me think it could be cured. And this is, especially in light of the statute of limitations problem, and this is an issue I review for an abuse of discretion.
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that in the brief, citing the DEA agent's manual 6612.43, which gives the special agents in charge the authority to purchase information, those same special agents were alleged by name in the original complaint, that by clearing that up and defining that those individuals who were SACs, who had authority under that code section, which was cited in the original complaint and in the brief, would in fact give authority and cure the authority problem. Now, and again, the issue with the statute of limitations, it's a disagreement.
The authority isn't that we're interested in, isn't the authority to go out and pay off informants. It's the authority of a person authorized within any of these agencies to enter into a contract with Mr. Torres.
Well, that in and of itself is a contract, Your Honor. That
no,
when,
it's not. When your client apparently, on his own dime, went to these places, out of his own pocket, paid informants, and he did all of this with no agreement of any kind that he's going to get reimbursed or repaid.
Well, I would suggest to the court, Your Honor, that in fact he did have an agreement with those special agents in charge who did contract with him in this respect, that if when you go out and perform...
But you never produced that agreement.
There's no writing, Your Honor. There's no question.
No, there's no agreement.
Well, it's an implied in fact contract, Your Honor, and that's what Mr. Toro is prepared to provide specific non-frivolous allegations of the implied in fact contract should the court grant the leave to amend. Your Honor, I will reserve the rest of my time unless there are further questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hammer. Mr. Rodriguez.
Good morning. May it please the court. I want to start with something that Mr. Toro's counsel just mentioned. He said that leave to amend shall be freely given except for, quote, when there's a repeated failure to cure deficiencies. Here we are 18 months after the filing of the complaint, and I believe that the court's concern about the lack of details is...
Well, it wasn't repeated. I mean, this was the first time that the complaint was sought to be amended, right?
No, what I mean by this, Your Honor, is the fact that 18 months in, we still have no idea who the agents with authority entered into the alleged contract with Mr. Toro, what the alleged terms were, what date the alleged contract was.
So it's not a repeated issue here, right?
No, it's not a repeated issue. These are repeated deficiencies. These are deficiencies that were made known
multiple.
To Mr. Toro's counsel.
I guess I would use the word multiple rather than repeated, but go ahead.
I guess my point, Your Honor, is that there has been ample opportunity for Mr. Toro to cure these deficiencies. And during the last 18 months...
Or to demonstrate that he's capable of curing them.
Correct, Your Honor. And that simply has not occurred. And like I said, to date, we still have no idea. Even if we were to try to break apart the claim and say, okay, well, what about the 2012 allegation from paragraph 18 of the complaint, perhaps there's something there. We have no way of determining what damages Mr. Toro is asserting for each of the claims that he alleges in his complaint or how he arrived at the $5 million damages figure that he claims. So I think, you know, the other issue with this, and the court is well aware of it, is a statute of limitations problem. Something that Mr. Toro has never briefed, has never responded either to this court or the court below. And I think that, Judge Reyna, your concern about the continuing claims doctrine is valid because that doctrine has never been applied to a confidential informant case. It's usually applied to periodic pay cases.
No, but look, I mean, if he had a contract and there's a serious problem that he doesn't really allege the things that are necessary for a contract, if there was a failure, if there was a request under pursuant to that contract in 2012 to take certain action, and he wasn't paid for that action, there wouldn't be a statute of limitations problem with that, would there?
I think, Your Honor, it's possible that there would not be. But again, this would be applying the continuing claims doctrine.
No, it's not. The continuing claims doctrine is when there are periodic payments over the course of time.
You can have a general contract with that authorized the government to make specific requests of the informant. You know, in 2012, do this, you know, get this information, and then there's no payment pursuant to that. Seems to me the statute of limitations hasn't run because that's within 6 years of the suit. Right?
I think, Your Honor, that...
Under that hypothetical, that's right, right?
In that hypothetical, if Mr. Toro could demonstrate that there were discrete and distinct wrongs pursuant to the alleged contract with their associated damages for each of those wrongs, perhaps there would be a claim. Now, in this particular case, Mr. Toro has never made that allegation. He's never attempted to break apart any of the claims in the 29-year period for which he says he worked under the implied in fact contract. So while there could perhaps be some claim related to a 2012 alleged breach, those aren't the allegations in the complaint. And again, we still have no idea how Mr. Toro is determining that he's owed $5 million in total for 29 years of alleged breaches.
I'm curious, and maybe this is something I can't talk about, but does the DEA in fact enter into contracts with informants in which it promises to pay money in return for certain services?
Yes, Your Honor. The DEA does enter into written contracts in which it promises to pay money and expenses. Each contract is different. This actually brings me to Mr. Toro's next argument about the DEA manual. Now, he claims that the DEA manual allows agents to pay commissions, essentially, pursuant to agreements. Now, that argument was also made by Mr. Toro's counsel in the Princess cases. And there, the Court of Federal Claims actually looked at the DEA manual. And in looking at it, the Court of Federal Claims noted that if there is an agreement pursuant to that section of the DEA manual that would pay commissions, it is always in writing because, first of all, it's highly unusual, but it's always in writing because, quote, there should be no gaps in understanding of the terms of the agreement. So again, I think that this idea that the DEA just enters into contracts has no regard for any written documents and then also orally agrees to authorize commissions is frankly not supported by the record or by any of the DEA's actual past history. So here I feel like this is sort of a frivolous argument. Again, the breakdown of this complaint is really that there was one agreement, a singular agreement that governed 29 years of activity for which Mr. Toro claims he was not paid. So again, we don't have any of the essential elements of an implied in fact contract. And Mr. Toro's...
I don't know, you may not be able to answer this, but was Mr. Toro reporting back to the DEA, submitting reports?
My understanding is that there were reports as pursuant to any confidential source who's working with an assigned DEA agent, that there are reports, that there's paperwork, there's a paper trail, and again, that there are documents that reflect the understanding of both the agent and the confidential source.
And was he paid for that activity?
My understanding is that he was paid for that activity.
He was paid expenses. Was he paid compensation beyond expenses?
My understanding, Your Honor, based on discussions with the DEA, is that there was compensation provided both for expenses and as well as compensation just for being a confidential source above the expenses that were paid.
Was that between the 86 and 2015 time frame?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why isn't any of this in the record?
Wasn't your burden to put it there?
It wasn't our burden to put it there. We did our own research on this, obviously, before we filed our motion to dismiss and determining whether or not we should answer the complaint. We determined that Mr. Toro's allegations were completely inaccurate and that there was not just one agreement that governed the conduct. There was a written agreement and that pursuant to the terms of the agreement, Mr. Toro was compensated.
So just to make sure I understand something, are you telling me so you've told us that there was, in fact, an agreement under which he was actually compensated, both compensation and expenses as well. That agreement was in writing? Is that what you're saying?
That's correct, Your Honor. At least the agreement, I believe that there were there was at least one agreement. There may have been others
have been
dependent
multiple.
On the specific task for which he was assigned.
I see.
But
did
that
Mr.
they
Toro
were,
ever ask you for a copy of that agreement?
Sorry, Your Honor?
Were you ever asked for the copy?
We were never asked for a copy of that agreement, Your Honor. In fact, you know, again, the allegations in the complaint are clear that there
Did you have,
is...
Was, has this been the position of the government that there has been no agreement with Mr. Toro?
No, that's not been the position. In fact, you can, if Your Honor so chooses, you can look at the transcript of the oral argument on the government's motion to dismiss where Judge Wheeler asked that same question, and we did answer. We said, look, our understanding is that there was an agreement, that there is a paper trail for each and every assignment that Mr. Toro was given, and that pursuant to the contract in place, he was compensated. So all of this has been consistent as far as our position and was made known to the trial court below.
And he's never alleged here that he wasn't properly compensated pursuant to the written agreements.
He's never, well, the allegations are a little bit fuzzy. I believe in the complaint he says he was never paid anything, and then later, both in the trial court and then before this court, he claims that he was actually paid expenses but no compensation. But again, I believe the allegation is clear. He was paid zero compensation throughout his time, and that's simply not true. So he doesn't have a disagreement.
I think that doesn't respond to my question. My understanding is that neither in the original complaint nor in any of the colloquy in connection with the dismissal of the complaint or the motion to amend, he never alleged that there was a written agreement which was breached.
He never alleged that. That's correct. Yeah. He simply alleges there was an oral agreement signed sometime in 1985 or 1986 about which he has no other factual information that would meet the essential elements of an implied in fact contract. If there are no further questions, I'll forego the use of the rest of my time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rodriguez.
Please, court. Mr. Toro is not alleging that he's owed commissions, as was represented by the government.
He's not making a claim under any written agreement, right?
Your Honor, Mr. Toro has represented to me that there was no written agreement, that he was not aware of a written agreement, that he did not enter into a written agreement. So as far as Mr. Toro, from his perspective, what he's represented to me is that he did not enter into a written agreement. There was no writing. Had I had the writing, I would have used that as a basis for the complaint. So from what he's alleged and the information he's provided me, which is extensive, there was no writing. He has alleged and continues to allege that he was reimbursed for his expenses, but he was not paid compensation pursuant to an implied in fact contract that he had during the course of his work with the DEA. So, you know, the information is in the hands of the government. I mean, the government says they have a writing. No, it's not been asked for, but Mr. Toro told me there wasn't a writing. That's why if the court will consent to allow an amendment, the allegations will be made with specificity. We can get into discovery. If it's then appropriate for a motion for summary judgment, that's a different issue. But the court, the lower court, didn't even tangentially address in dicta the issue of the statute of limitations. There was no ruling by Judge Wheeler in the Court of Federal Claims with regard to the statute of limitations issue. There are these distinct events that can be identified and for which Mr. Toro would request the court grant leave to amend. If there are no further questions, that's all I plead to pass.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Avery.
Thank
both counsel. The case is submitted.